The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Melissa Faye Green, her book, The Underdogs, Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love, has been the big read book in our community for the last month or so, and we're celebrating the final week of the big read, and Melissa has come all the way out here from Atlanta to see us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vic.
Melissa, we did an interview when this book came out, and you told me a fascinating story about how you were just being polite to somebody. And there was a woman in Atlanta who had, she and her husband had adopted a little boy from Russia. And this child had some issues. And she contacted you and wanted to talk to you about a book project. And this really was the impetus. This is the beginning, wasn't it? Tell us what happened, please.
I get approached a certain amount by people who want to publish a book and think that somehow I can help make that happen. My husband's a criminal defense attorney, and most criminal defense attorneys in Atlanta, I think that they're the next Scott Turow and have a book project that they would like me to handle. So I've gotten really good at avoiding those kinds of conversations. An email came in one day from a woman asking if we could get together so that I could tell her how to publish a book that she had not written yet. And I thought, oh, no, you know, how quickly can I say no? But I clicked on the link that was in her email and read her story and thought, this family's been through hell. I can meet her for coffee. This was a woman named Donnie Winokur. She and her husband, Rabbi Harvey Winokur, had gone through infertility. In their late 40s, they adopted two children from Russia. They thought it was just a fairy tale, the family they'd always wanted. The little girl was fine, but the little boy started exhibiting more and more worrisome behaviors. He didn't listen. He woke up in the night screaming, and he threw fits all the time, and he got triggered by really weird things, like a sticker on a banana. It would cause him to just freak out. He could freak out for hours. Donnie, the mom, said she thought it was all her fault, that she wasn't a good enough mother, and her friends would try to console her and say, oh, he's all boy, mine was the same way. But as his behaviors got more and more weird, they thought, well, maybe there's something. At preschool, he would sit on his tricycle and plow right into other children and not even seem to notice. They went through a bunch of specialists, racked up a score of diagnoses, but the blow really fell when the little boy, Ayal, was four, when he was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, FAS, that his birth mother in Russia had evidently been a heavy drinker, and this was permanent brain damage. The family went into a tailspin of despair and isolation. They couldn't all leave the house at the same time. Nothing worked. They went through a bunch of different medications. Nothing worked, and they were really in a very dark and lonely place when Donnie heard about an organization in faraway Xenia, Ohio, called Four Paws for Ability, that unlike any other dog academy, dog training academy in the country, was actually training service dogs for children. Everyone else was telling parents no, but Four Paws was training dogs for children. So Donnie called thinking this was the last shot, and that if they said no at Four Paws, she was out of ideas. And she called and reached a woman named Karen Shirk, who was the director of Four Paws. And Donnie said, do you know what FAS is? No, it's fetal alcohol syndrome. Have you heard of that? Haven't really worked with it, Karen said. So Donnie explained her son's symptoms and behaviors. And Karen said, that doesn't sound so different from a lot of our children. And Donnie Winokur said, you're going to give us a dog? And Karen said, it just doesn't sound that different. If you and your husband can take good care of a dog, and you'll be the handlers for a dog, and the dog will be safe with your family, we can give your family a dog. That was the beginning of an incredible life change for the Winokur family. Anyway, I'm sitting at Starbucks with Donnie Winokur, and she's telling me this spellbinding story Earlier, she had a pad of paper and a pencil, and she was jotting down my little notes about how to get published. But at some point, I said, "Wait, give me your paper and pencil," and I started writing. And I said, "Would you want me to write about this?" And she said, "Would you?" Because really, her mission at that time was to get the word out about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and to warn young women not to drink during pregnancy, that there's no safe amount, not even a single glass of wine. Just wait. Don't do it. That was her mission. So I reported the story and wrote a feature story for the New York Times Magazine that went viral. It was the most popular thing I've ever written. And then thought, this is all such an amazing story. And there were all of these families. And Karen Shirk, the director, is herself an amazing story, an amazing survivor. Could this be a book? And pretty quickly after the publication of the Times article, it was sold to a publisher and then became a book that was published 2 years ago.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program Melissa Faye Green. Her book is The Underdogs, Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love. And you tell the story in the book about how Four Paws for Ability started and Karen Shirk's story. And it's a very powerful story, and Four Paws for Ability, along with the Greene County Library, has become something that folks in Xenia are very proud of. And I am delighted to surprise our radio listeners by saying that we have been joined on the program by Karen Shirk. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
Wow, this is a treat, and you have a guest. Is this Boone that you brought with you?
This is Boone. If you've read the book, it's Piper's grandson.
And Boone is a beautiful, what
he's a papillon.
That's it, a papillon. Mm-hmm. Wow, what a beautiful, and Boone is very excited right now to be mentioned on the radio.
I think he's actually very excited about all the people he thinks are looking at him.
Well, I think he's right. Melissa tells your story in the book about how you started this organization. Do you feel like telling us yourself how it happened?
Sure. I started the organization after my own search to find a service dog. I was in college, and I was developed myasthenia gravis muscular dystrophy, and it hit me very hard back then, and I became very, very, very disabled and was ventilator dependent. And some people had told me about service dogs, and I had looked them up. I always had dogs, loved dogs, thought it was a great alternative to always having to have a person there. And tried to get a service dog for a number of years and was turned down by every agency. They would never tell me why until the last agency that left me hanging for 2 years, telling me they would give me a dog, and then came to visit me telling me they were ready, had a dog for me, and, "Oh, I'm sorry, we didn't know that you were on a ventilator." And I said, "Why does that make a difference?" "Well, people on ventilators have a very poor prognosis." And I was like, "Okay." And I was pretty done with life at that point. And the people that knew me were trying to get me, especially my healthcare nurse, who was really close with me, was trying to find a way to kind of bring me back from that, because I'd pretty much given up at that point, and was dragging me to look at dogs, like that would make a difference to me, she thought. And we went, and there was a litter of black German Shepherds, which when I was born, my parents got a black German Shepherd, so it's the first dog I ever knew. And I'm thinking, I can't even take care of myself. What am I going to do with this puppy? And we're looking, and all the puppies were running around in the front like, "Oh, pet me, pet me." And this puppy just sat in the back and looked at me with the wisest look. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do this. Mm-hmm. And we got the puppy, and then slowly but surely, you know, Ben was his name, he brought me back to life and back to getting out of my apartment and eventually going back to the workforce. And I started to think about, you know, are lots of other people, does this happen to them? Are they told no? Are they able to get a dog? Are they able to find a trainer? You know, does everybody have the resources? I mean, I was a pretty go-getter all my life, so you know, it was pretty easy for me once I am determined to do something. So I started For Pause actually thinking that I would work with a lot of people like myself. But it turned out that evidently there's not a lot of people like me because they weren't finding me. And but all of the parents with children were, because a parent with a 12-year-old who was turned down by every agency because she was 12. And she had been she had had a stroke in her neck and was paralyzed. And when I met her, she had a halo on her head, mm-hmm. one of those big contraptions. And I said yes, and that went pretty fast. The word of that went around pretty fast, and all of these parents kept contacting me, and I was like, why are these parents not able to get dogs for their children? I mean, they're able-bodied. They're not on ventilators, you know? And nobody would give them dogs. And when I talked to the service dog community at conferences that I went to, they would tell me, oh, you can't do that. Mm. And it was all because they didn't think the child can handle the dog. And so the parent handles the dog. It's not a big deal. But that grew really fast. And Four Paws grew really, really, really fast into the very, very big agency that it is today.
Mm. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. The Book Nook on the Road continues right after this.
It's the Book Nook on the Road. We're recording the program live at the Little Art Theater in front of a live audience. Is there anybody out there listening right now? The Greene County Library has made this event possible, along with the Little Art Theater and WYSO. And we have a special guest here from Atlanta and another special guest here from Xenia, Karen Shirk from Four Paws for Ability, and Melissa Faye Green, who wrote about this organization in her book, The Underdogs, Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love. It's been the big read book. Melissa, were you surprised when the book was picked for the big read? What was the feeling when you heard?
My feeling was that Karen Shirk and Four Paws have such an incredible following that she probably organized everyone to vote early and vote often.
Well, very effective.
I was not surprised, no.
I was delighted when I saw that it was the book that was chosen, because I can remember when I first read it just saying, wow, what a story. Karen, is it really true that this was the first organization to allow children to have these dogs?
We were the first organization that we know of that have placed the dogs as true service dogs. There were organizations that would give their failed dogs to children to use in the home. But there weren't organizations at that time that would actually place the dog as a service dog that could work in public.
Mm. Melissa, I'm in a wonderful position here because I'm seated between these two articulate guests. And I'm thinking, well, I don't really even need to do any work. Why don't you interview Karen, and I'll just sit back and enjoy it?
Four Paws became kind of the gold standard among service dog academies. Every dog gets, is it 500 hours of training?
Yeah, between everybody from the inmates to the college students, the foster homes, the volunteer trainers, the socializers, and our professional trainers, yes.
The amazing thing is every dog gets all this tremendous amount of training, but about 100 hours of the training go toward preparing a dog for a specific child. Even before that, they breed many of their dogs, so they know the dogs from birth, and the trainers and everyone working with the dogs pay attention to what a dog seems to like. And that was one of the things that was so interesting and surprising to me early on. It's not like they just say, all right, this one's going to, you know, be a mobility dog and that one is going to be a tracking dog. They wait and see what a dog seems to enjoy. I tell a story in the book about a dog who had a really good nose. They knew from a very young age that this dog really could be a great search and rescue dog. A dog, you know, let's place a dog like this with, for example, a child on the autism spectrum who runs away. And I've got a couple of kids like that in the book where families are just desperate. They turn around and the kid's gone. And so Four Paws will train dogs who will track that child. It's not like call 911. you tell the dog, where's Jasper? And the dog's gone. So this was a dog they really admired. Great nose. This will be a tracking dog. But every time they took the dog to a field to work with him, it wasn't what the dog wanted to do. And correct me if I'm saying this wrong, but they would have one trainer would hold the dog. They would give the scent of another trainer. And so then the second trainer would go hide. And then they could say, find Jess. Where's Jess? But this dog, when they released him, would run over and pick up, a Coke can that had been discarded and happily bring it back. And they're like, no, where's Jess? Let's find Jess. Off he goes. Back he comes with a McDonald's wrapper, you know. And the head trainer took him out one day, you know, like, for God's sakes, this is a great nose on this dog. And then they talk about Jeremy coming in later that day with his arms full of Coke cans and wrappers and said, this is not a search and rescue dog. This is a mobility dog. And so they trained him for a child who needed things like, can you bring me the book? And then that was the job this dog wanted to do, was to go bring something. And so that became that. So they pay really close attention to what will make the dogs happy, because if the dogs ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. They want the dogs to be happy too. When they trained, it was actually a rescue golden retriever named Chancer. This was the dog they chose for Eyal Winokur, the boy with fetal alcohol syndrome. One of the issues that Eyal had was throwing these tremendous fits over nothing. He would say he didn't want his mother touching his food. He said he could smell his mother on his food, and he would throw fits. The way he would throw fits was he would cross his arms, sit down hard, bang his feet, and scream, and bang his head against the wall. He could do this for an hour, risking damaging, hurting himself. After a year of fundraising and then 10 days of training one-on-one with Chancer, they brought Chancer home to Roswell, Georgia. And after a couple of days, here it came. Eyal threw one of his fits, crossed his arms, sat down, started screaming, banging his head. And the parents had been told to say to Chancer, disrupt. It didn't seem to capture the emergency that was unfolding with this kid, but Chancer had been trained for Eyal. He'd been trained for this boy. So here's now the boy in action, screaming, arms crossed. And so the parents said, Chancer, disrupt. And the way Chancer hears it, Karen and the trainers have explained, the way the dogs hear it is game on. This is what they've been trained to do. So they say disrupt. Chancer hears game on. Chancer runs over to Eyal, who's sitting there with his arms crossed, and Chancer noses in. He sort of noses up, starting at Ayal's tummy, noses up, opens up the arms, you know, opening Ayal's arms, and comes just snuffling and nosing up Ayal's chest and neck, knocks Eyal over backwards, gets on top of him, and he's licking and licking him. And Eyal, the fit turns into laughter. And then Chancer lies on Eyal till the fit passes. Within just a few weeks, they didn't need to say disrupt to Chancer because he could hear it if Eyal sat down and started to scream. There wasn't even time to say disrupt. Chancer was on it, game on, he knew. And then the most amazing thing, starting a couple of months later, was that Chancer started disrupting events before they happened. Chancer knew when Eyal was going to lose it, so he didn't even need to wait and hear Chancer hit the floor. I mean, Eyal hit the floor and bang his head. He could be sprawled out on the living room sofa. Eyal could be upstairs doing something, and suddenly Chancer would alert. There hadn't even been a sound yet, and Chancer would run up the stairs, find Eyal, rear up, push Eyal down and get on top of him and lie there, sheltering him from the world until whatever was about to happen passed.
I love that story.
Why don't you tell about how you ended up having Papillons in your lap as your own service dogs? They probably think Boone is here because he's so unbelievably cute, but... And there's that. But they have amazing skills. Karen, the head of Four Paws, was not aware how brainy Papillons were until one kind of showed up and taught you all.
Yeah, so a breeder from California called and said that she had a little dog that had been born with a chicken wing leg. And she thought that this dog would be a great therapy dog. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, that could be. So I said, sure, if you want to send her out here, we'll find some kind of job for her.
And so that means a deformity. One leg was deformed.
One leg was like a little chicken wing, and she hopped on three legs.
Did you amputate that or no?
No, no. She had that her whole life. And I went to the airport to pick her up, and I had big dogs my whole life, and my service dog, Ben, was a 136-pound black German Shepherd. So when I showed up at the airport, I didn't realize when she said little dog, she meant little bitty. It was 8 weeks old. So I went, oh, my, what in the world did I get myself into? I'm looking at this cat carrier. And I look inside, and there's this tiny little rat in there. And I was like, okay, yeah, you never know. Well, I got to take her home now. So I took her home.
I remember you saying, just what I need, a three-legged papillon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I took her home, and at the end of the first week, I called the breeder and said, I think Four Paws needs a mascot. Because, like, I think it was maybe the fourth day, we were having a class with some kids that had autism, and the girl was, family had come to visit to see if it worked for their child, and the girl was petrified of the dogs. And so the girl was sitting way over on the side, and Gracie kind of inked up to her. And before the end of the day, they were smiling and laughing, and I still have a picture of them together. And I thought, oh, this dog is really cute. Then we realized how smart she was. And even Jeremy, he was like, well, if we were going to train a small dog, this would be the breed to train. And
I think Gracie, if I remember correctly, trained herself. They weren't paying much attention to her. So here's this little three-legged papillon underfoot. And the dogs in the training circle were learning sit. And one of the trainers said, sit. And all the dogs in the training circle sat. And Gracie, who was just wandering around out here with the kennels, sat. Wasn't that right?
Yeah.
She started.
Yeah.
And then Karen actually looked up. Papillon, are these even, what are these? And they were on the list of like the top 10 most intelligent breeds.
Top 10 most intelligent and top 10 most trainable. So we decided to go into them. And when I called the breeder of Gracie to ask about breeding dogs, she said, sure. I kept Gracie's sister Piper as a show dog, but something about her rear end was a little bit taller than her back or something. And it was minute, but she wouldn't be able to go in the show ring. And she would be happy to send her to me. And so about 4 months later, Piper joined us. And at that time, I actually lived Four Paws. I literally lived in Four Paws. And so Piper and Gracie lived at Four Paws with me. And I think about 3 or 4 months after Piper came to live with us, I started noticing that she would claw frantically at me. And then
She would jump up on you and claw at your chest, right? Uh-huh.
And I have these, what's called a myasthenic exacerbation, which is when all of my muscles start to systematically shut down, and which is why I have a trach. So if they shut down, my diaphragm shuts down. And if your diaphragm shuts down, there's no breathing. And I said, I told Jeremy, I think this dog is alerting. And he's like, well, journal it. So I started to journal it. And after, it only happens like 5 or 6 times a year, so it took a while. But after 3 or 4 times, I'm like, this dog is alerting. She's alerting 20 minutes ahead of time, which allows me the time I need to take a medication, Mestinon, that actually lessens the severity. So before Piper alerted, I was hospitalized 5 to 6 times a year, event dependent. After Piper, I was never hospitalized since once for a myasthenic exacerbation. And Piper alerted faithfully for 11 years, and she passed away at the age of 12 when Mr. Boone was 3 months old. And so Boone, who was supposed to go to California, stayed with me, and he also alerts. He's not what we would call in the world of service dog work the most professional service dog because of his fondness for barking at other dogs. And so I also have another papillon named Iko, who one of our trainers trained for me, who does our normally represents Four Paws with me anytime that there might be another dog there, because, you know, otherwise I'm like this. Vest. I bought it online. Don't know what Four Paws is. Nope. Fake service dog. You know, because, you know, he does his best, but... So, but he alerts, and that's fantastic, and I use them in instances like this where it's fairly safe, so.
And isn't it the case that a lot of dogs somehow self-identify that they can be good at this kind of thing the way Piper did?
We do. All of our dogs, we don't make any of our dogs do anything. So usually when they're about 9 months old, they come in for testing, and we have tons of paperwork from the volunteers that have raised them, and we have reports from evaluations and things, and the trainers do an evaluation, and they look for what their talents are, the same as we, as us. You know, when you're getting ready for college and you have to figure out what your talents are, and then we use their talents, whereas, you know, some agencies that only train mobility dogs might be inclined to force a dog to do mobility work. We don't have to. If the dog's not good at mobility work, they do something else.
So a lot of the clients are families whose children have seizure disorder. And the Papillons, a lot of them turn out to be really good at predicting when a child is going to have a seizure, the same way Piper was predicting.
We use them exclusively for diabetic alert, and then we use some of them for seizure work. The problem with seizure work is a lot of these kids also have other disabilities, and so a lot of times we'll place bigger dogs with them because they don't know to be too gentle, and that's one of the drawbacks of a small dog. Diabetic alert, medical alert, seizure alert, fantastic.
The family shares such amazing stories. One story I was told, a family whose child had seizure disorder, and so, of course, the service dog was there in the classroom with the child. And one day the dog left the child's side and went across the room and sat down by a different child. And how do they alert? Would the dog have barked?
We train the dogs to bark.
Yes. And the teacher saw this and said, you know, get back to your boy. No, get back where you belong. So the dog went back, but a moment later again crossed the room and went to sit by a little girl across the room and alerted again. And again the teacher said, get back to Ryan here. Finally, the dog went up front and was pawing at the teacher, clearly indicating this little girl who had no history of seizures, and the child seized. And the dog was alerting to another, not his own child, but that another child was going to seize. Yeah.
You're listening to a very special recording of the Book Nook on the Road. We made it at the Little Art Theater earlier this month. Peter Hayes handling the sound, and really a great time on stage with our special guests. And I hope to see some of you this morning. Later today, I will be at the Clark County Public Library at 11 o'clock this morning. That's Saturday, April 28th, and I'll be part of the 2018 Springfield Writes Author Fair. I'm not an author, but I'll be talking about authors, so I hope to see you in Springfield this morning. I will be giving a talk about authors I have known, and if you come to the Clark County Public Library at 201 South Fountain Avenue, I will be there speaking from 11 until noon. And then the author fair will be in the main library rotunda from 12:30 until 2 o'clock. That's the Springfield Writes Author Fair this morning. I'll be speaking at 11 o'clock. I hope to see some of you there. The Book Nook on the Road will continue right after this.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, The Book Nook on the Road. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined on stage at the Little Art Theater by Melissa Faye Green. We're talking about the Big Read book this year, The Underdogs, Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love. It's the story of Four Paws for Ability, and we've been joined on stage by Karen Shirk, the founder of Four Paws for Ability, which is located in Xenia, Ohio. And I think one of my favorite stories in the book, Melissa, is the one where you talk about your dachshund getting lost. Okay. Do you want to recount that story where you couldn't find your dog and you had another dog that was going to help you find that dog?
So my book is full of all kinds of amazing, heroic stories about amazing, heroic dogs. But in full disclosure, the dogs in my family, we love them more than anything. We haven't necessarily seen the amazing heroic action. So I think I had written, I think that was probably the chapter where there were twins, also in Georgia, both on the autism spectrum, one of whom was a runner, kept disappearing, and they got a search and rescue, a tracking dog from Four Paws, and so that dog was doing amazing rescues. So one year we had this ridiculous little dachshund and several other dogs, and the dachshund disappeared in a thunderstorm, something had scared him, and then we couldn't, it was a little miniature black dachshund, and just disappeared, and we couldn't find him, and we just hiked through the woods and up and down the neighborhood, just calling his name, calling, and put up posters everywhere. It was almost a week when we heard from a neighbor. Just three doors down, they had a little fish pond in their backyard, and they said when the storm was over, there was a weasel that had appeared in their pond. And when they first saw the weasel, they thought, they couldn't even tell if the weasel was alive. The weasel was not moving. And they went up the next day, and the weasel was still there, unmoving, just hanging onto the edge of the pond. And they thought, that's nice, we have a weasel. And the third day went out, and the weasel was still there, and they fished it out, and it was Theo, the missing dachshund. And the thing about that story is we had been within, like, 10 feet of that pond. We had been right there with my other dogs. What did they think? What did they think we were doing? And we were yelling Theo's name. Theo, Theo, where are you? And here's Franny, who would spend her entire life with Theo, Franny the rat terrier. And she was like, I don't know. Or or did she see him and think, he went for a swim? We couldn't. Then one of my favorite stories in the book partly happened at Emory University, which is about three blocks from where we live. There were all kinds of great discoveries happening in the world of animal intelligence, and even animals like octopuses, all kinds of amazing animals begin to reveal remarkable intelligence, and there was just a revolution in how scientists looked at animals, especially starting in the mid and late 90s, but not dogs. They drew the line at dogs. They weren't studying dogs, because they felt dogs were too domesticated, too man-made in some way. Weren't they all commodities invented in Victorian England or something? Not dogs. So all the brave field biologists that were hiking off to study, you know, tigers and gorillas and all kinds of wonderful animals, you just couldn't, with colleagues like that, study dogs. So there was a biologist at Emory who was interested in, he was a neurologist, all kinds of things. He was interested in pointing, which young children do, human children do, at a very young age. By about 9 or 10 months of age, some children can start to understand pointing. They understand if you're pointing, they understand a look, and sometimes the baby will point, that the baby wants something. He wondered if chimpanzees could do this, and he thought if they can't, our nearest relatives, then it means it's a uniquely human skill. And it makes us, it's something that makes us human. We understand pointing, and chimpanzees can't understand pointing. I was very excited about this. I realize that a lot of academics are looking for the thing that makes us uniquely human, because then you can publish on that, and it's really exciting. So he was working with the chimpanzees at the Yerkes Institute, affiliated with Emory, and they would put two plastic pails in front of a chimpanzee, and there'd be a treat in front of one of the pails. And the test was that the researcher would look at the chimpanzee and then go with a pointer finger, point at one of the pails to say that the treat's under this pail. Then the chimpanzee got to pick. Chimpanzees would go for the, it was no better than 50-50. It meant nothing to the chimpanzees, at least in this context, that a researcher was pointing at the red bucket instead of the blue bucket. It didn't do anything for the chimpanzees. So this professor was like, voila, I've got it. This is the thing that makes us human. Well, there was an undergraduate named Brian Hare in that lab, and he said, my dog can do that. The professor, with disappointment, said, oh, right, everybody's dog can do calculus. So the undergraduate, Brian Hare, went home and took a video of his dog, Oreo, running around in the backyard. Brian would like to, he enjoyed having batting practice, so he would hit tennis balls. The ball would fly under a bush. Brian would point, and Oreo would run to whatever bush Brian pointed to and bring the tennis ball. So he showed the professor, who was not pleased, but unhappily invited Oreo to come into the lab for the bucket test. So they did the test with Oreo and put a treat under one bucket, and then and in that case they had to get, you know, smell odor-proof buckets, or the dog could have told that way, and Brian would point at the correct bucket, and bang, Oreo went right for it. He could totally understand pointing. So they started bringing in dogs from all over the neighborhood. We're in that neighborhood. And they brought in all these dogs, pointed at a bucket. The dogs did it. They brought in puppies, pointed. The puppies understood pointing. My dogs don't have the SAT scores to get into Emory University. My dogs do not understand pointing. I've done all this research. I know these professors. We got the buckets. We got the treat. We did all the nothing. My dogs don't understand pointing. But in general, a lot of dogs understand pointing, so it's not a genius unique to humans. Brian Hare went on to become one of the leading dog researchers in the world. And after stopping his professor from publishing an article about the genius of humans, he published a book called The Genius of Dogs. You can go to his website, I think it's dognition.com, and find out if your dog is a genius. I'm avoiding that website myself, but you all may have dogs that understand pointing.
Melissa, how is it possible that people for so long doing research didn't realize what most of us here in this audience probably already knew, that dogs and animals had thoughts and feelings? How could they possibly not be aware of this?
I think it stemmed especially from an era before field biologists, before some of the early great ones like Diane Fossey and George Schaller and Jane Goodall were going into the field and looking at animal societies and watching and, you know, crouching down and spending months or years or decades watching the world of animals in their wild settings. What was happening before that is that laboratory scientists were bringing animals into their labs and testing them on things that might have made sense if you were testing humans. And these things didn't make sense to the animals. Now listen, chimpanzees may understand pointing, but in the chimpanzee world, according to the great primatologists, chimpanzees, and maybe bonobos do it differently, but chimpanzees don't help one another out. So it's not really in their toolkit to point to another chimpanzee how to find a treat. That's not what they're doing. They're waiting until that chimpanzee's looking away, and they're getting the treat themselves. Does that make chimpanzees stupid? It doesn't. But it explains why a chimpanzee in a laboratory is not reacting to a human researcher pointing at a pink bucket. It didn't, you know, but it doesn't mean they were stupid. And when you had field biologists going into the wild and looking at how animals actually lived, they saw intelligence and emotion to be the underpinnings of everything they saw, whereas the lab scientists were seeing neither emotion nor intelligence in the animals they studied.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and we're talking about the underdogs, children dogs, and the power of unconditional love. And it's the Big Read book this year, and the Greene County Library brought us here to the Little Art Theater to record the Book Nook on the road, and Melissa came in for this special event, and we also have a very special guest on stage with us, the founder of Four Paws for Ability, Karen Shirk. Karen, what's it been like running this operation out of Xenia, Ohio? What's it like for you?
Oh, it's probably the most amazing thing that I've ever done. I really enjoy it. I don't feel like I have a job. It's just part of my life, you know. I don't think that I would ever want to not get up and go into Four Paws and spend the day there.
Get up in a bed that's covered with 10 dogs, right?
Right now, 5.
Okay.
But yes.
Are they all Papillons?
They are.
Really?
I have also 3 German Shepherds, but they sleep in the other side of the house.
You mentioned Ben.
earlier. Tell us about Ben. He was a special guy, wasn't he?
Ben was amazing. So I got Ben at a time in my life when I literally could do almost nothing for myself. And with Ben, rediscovered life. Not only just, got me back. I went back to work. I did dog shows with him, was able to do, you know, the things people do where they go and the dogs do obedience. I didn't train him, but I took the credit for his intelligence in the competitive dog ring. And I did actually train him when he was a puppy. I went to obedience classes with him. And that's where what got me out first. It started with obedience classes and went to, well, if I can go out and do this, maybe I can do this, and went back to work. And Ben actually saved my life, I say twice. The first time he saved my life because I was really, literally had thought about killing myself. I just really didn't want, I saw that I would live like that the rest of my life and didn't want to live like that. And Ben brought me back into life. And then after open heart surgery, I had a morphine pump malfunction and was pretty much unconscious. Well, was unconscious. And my dad called to check on me, and Ben knocked the phone off the hook and barked and barked and barked. And my dad, who lived an hour away, called the police, who came out and got the rescue people came in. I was given Narcan and, you know, brought back again. So, and pretty much if he had not done that, by the time somebody found me, I would have been too late.
So Ben knocked the phone off the hook, and your father could hear you breathing.
He could hear me breathing, labored breathing, and he knew that Ben would not bark like that for no reason.
Tell about Ben at the park with the child on the swing.
That was really cool. Actually, this is the thing that made me realize that dogs could do amazing things. We were at a camp, and a child was on the swing, and he jumped up, and he literally grabbed this child off the swing. I mean, I thought he was having a mental health breakdown. I was like, oh, what am I going to do? I'm apologizing. You know, I'm holding him. I'm like, I have no idea what came over him. And, you know, the child was fine. Another child jumps on the swing and starts to go. He's going bananas, but I've got a hold of him this time. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? And the swing broke, and the child fell to the ground. It was crazy. It was like he knew. I don't know how, but it was like he knew that swing was going to break. And I think that was the first time I really realized that, you know, this is long before Piper alerting and all of the things that we trained them to do at Four Paws. It was kind of my first glimpse at the magic of dogs.
I love these stories, and I love the fact that we're able to be here with a live audience sharing them with you. And how many dog lovers do we have in the audience? Are there any cat lovers in the audience? Thank you. Thank you for that.
They have cats at Four Paws. People drop off all sorts of dogs, I mean all sorts of animals, thinking there's some kind of shelter. And so Karen has such a big heart, they keep whatever they can keep, and they find homes for whoever they can find homes for. But I learned a lot from the cat that lived at Four Paws. This is a cat living among hundreds of dogs. And she just walked through, and the dogs were like, okay, okay. And what I learned was that if the cat doesn't run, the dogs don't chase. And the cat had learned. The cat just walked through Four Paws, and they were like, yes, ma'am, you know. And she, yeah.
The book is Underdogs, Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, a special live presentation being recorded at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And this has been put on by the Greene County Library, and this has really been fun to sit here and talk to you here on stage. It's very unusual. I can't remember ever having a dog on the program.
I'm glad that he was quiet.
He's just...
It's not over yet.
such a well-behaved creature, and he knows we're talking about him, doesn't he?
Yes, of course.
Incarcerated men learn how to train the dogs and do basic obedience with the dogs and bond with the dogs and get incredible sense of self-esteem from doing that work with the dogs.
Yep.
You have accounts in the book, Melissa, about prisoners who, well, I think one you mentioned is the Birdman of Alcatraz, prisoners who find these little injured creatures, birds or what have you, and just tenderly care for them and how this is so life-changing for them.
I got off on sort of an odd, took sort of an odd tack after visiting the prison with Helen, just one with Karen. Helen's my daughter, I don't know why I said. That there's a whole history of animals in prisons, and it's pretty fascinating. And there's a maximum security prison in Indiana where it's maximum security. This is a tough prison. This is a prison where these are felons, these are murderers. And a cat appeared one day on the grounds of the prison, and then just like that, the cat disappeared. And the prison went into lockdown. No one knew what had become of the cat, and no one said anything. But what had happened was that the cat turned out to be pregnant and had kittens, and the prisoners began sharing out the kittens secretly with one another. The guards sensed that something was afoot, that something was going on, and again they put the prison in lockdown, and they were searching on all the cells. But instead of finding weapons, knives, contraband, they were finding, like, little toys and little, you know, little toys made of paper and little toys on strings. Like, what is going on? So then they realized the place was crawling with cats. And they gave an invitation to the prisoners and said, if you will report and register your cat, we won't take your cat away. And the prisoners were worried but really had no choice. So the men came forward and registered their cats. And now there's a thriving cat community in this maximum security prison. There was no way to justify putting pictures of this in the book because the book was about dogs. But the pictures were so amazing. And here are these men in these cells, but they've built all kinds of tunnels and all kinds of fun things, like in a hamster exhibit where the cats can visit one another. And the prison now has a close relationship with cat lovers in the neighborhood in this town. And they take kittens back and forth. Anyway, really, they're great stories.
I've been joined by Melissa Faye Green and Karen Shirk on the program today. And Melissa, when we wind up interviews, I quite often will inquire as to what you might be working on. The first time I had you on the show was for your book, The Temple Bombing. I think that was about 22 years ago. And I'm just wondering, this book's been out for a little while. Is there a book project that you're looking at or thinking about right now?
There was a book project I was working on. I didn't even tell you yet. It's not going to happen. I was working on a book about gun violence research and about the Dickey Amendment that shut down the gun violence research and the need to restart it. But everything that's happened in the last few weeks since Parkland has moved the needle so far that it's an unbelievably important story, but I can no longer keep up with it. There's no way a book can now keep up with the story because the Parkland students have accelerated the rate of the story so much that I think if the blue wave happens this fall, God willing, that there could be gun violence research funded once again at CDC a year from now. So that book's not going to happen. I'm focusing this coming year on teaching. I'm teaching at Agnes Scott College in Atlanta. And so I'm going to do that while looking for a quieter story farther from the headlines than gun violence.
Well, it's really been a treat to have you back on the program.
I was going to say dogs and Karen are a really hard act to follow. I would have liked I would have liked to keep this book going indefinitely. Yeah.
And Karen Shirk, thank you so much for being part of the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Boone as well. Boone is her papillon who is hearing exactly what I'm saying about him, and he's quite proud. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. This special Book Nook on the Road presentation has been brought to you by the Greene County Library, the Little Art Theater, WYSO, and all the good folks here in our audience. Thank you so much for coming, and for all of you out there listening in the radio land, thanks for tuning in.